Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Leading up to the United Nations Food System Summit, we've launched an interview series called Laying Down Tracks, an effort to speak with global leaders about food, production, and all of its impact. For the final episode of the 8-part miniseries, today we welcome the UN Secretary General Special Envoy for the 2021 Food System Summit, Dr. Agnes Kalibata. Welcome, Agnes. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me, Aaron. I look forward to this.
As do I. And again, it's a wonderful opportunity. After reading and hearing more of your background, I'm excited for what our audience will learn today. For the first question I have for you, I've heard the Food Systems Summit being described as the People's Summit. Could you please share with us what that means to you and why it's so important that all voices are represented in this conversation?
So the idea of the Food Systems Summit being referred to as a People's Summit recognizes a number of things, primarily that the Food Systems Summit is trying to help countries get back on track to come through on SDGs, recognizing that coming through on SDGs is fulfilling some of the very basic human rights. For example, dealing with poverty, dealing with the question of hunger and zero hunger, malnutrition, some of the very basic human rights are some of the things that we are dealing with from an SDG perspective. So that's number one. Number two, it also recognizes that we are trying to come through on SDGs at a time when our food systems are really beginning to buckle under the weight of our expectation. And let me qualify that. We are contributing to emissions. We are probably the third source of emissions with close to 30% emissions. We are losing biodiversity at a very fast rate, and food systems are responsible for that. So so all this really is what our food system is looking like today. Making it a People's Summit is recognizing that each of us has an opportunity to do something about it. We eat three times a day. Each of those meals is a decision process. Some of it is part of our culture. Some of it is what we love. Some of it is because we have to eat. It's a decision moment. It takes a lot from our environment. So in influencing and educating people and helping people understand that changing our food system is going to depend on how each of us owns that responsibility and comes back to the landscape, to the food environment, demanding and ensuring that our demands are anchored in a very good understanding of the fact that we need to reduce our footprint on the environment, because our environment cannot take it anymore. So really, my expectation is that we can reduce our demands, mostly because we do understand that our demands on the environment are impacting what our environment can give us in the future.
Pretty aggressive goals for the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, those SDGs, those 17 SDGs that lay out all types of scenarios. And to your point, food systems, food, what we consume daily, is that connective tissue that seems to coax its way into each one of those SDGs. So how do we go about that engagement process? How do we inform, educate those consumers that they are not just part of the problem, but really the, not just even part of the solution, they are the solution? What's the engagement process?
Yeah, so thank you so much. And I love the being the solution perspective, because that's how I look at it. So we have designed an engagement process that first of all recognizes that we are in this. The Food Systems Summit was launched to help member states come through on the SDGs, like you've said, and again, come through recognizing the challenges. So we have dialogues happening across member states. We now have 136 member states out of 196 that are already doing dialogues. And the value of dialogues means that we get a number of sectors that usually don't talk to each other, that come to sit and talk together around how their food systems are working. So the primary area is national level dialogues where different sectors are sitting and having conversations. The second place is we have independent dialogues that do recognize that different communities need to get together and have conversations around food systems and how they impact them. So we do have private sector dialogues, we do have producer dialogues, fisher dialogues, indigenous peoples dialogues, youth dialogues, all sorts of conversations that really help people meet and engage around what is working and what's not working. The third type of dialogues is we have a food systems community, an online community that allows anybody anywhere to engage with the food system. And then there are other ways of engaging, whether it is through action tracks, being part of that conversation that is trying to find solutions, or whether it is through champions, that we have champions on the Food System Summit that are also people that are engaging in to try to understand what the Food System Summit is coming up with and take that information back into their network. So we have a network of champions. And then we have the scientific group that is engaging all institutions, scientific institutions, national institutions, on the science of the food system, where it is at today, and where it could go in the future, and how we could transition it, and what evidence there is for that to be the case. So there are lots of conversations. Each of these dialogues is an opportunity to bring in people. Each of these dialogues is an opportunity to tweet something, message something that other people will get to hear. The key message being our food systems are at a critical point, given the fact that we need to stay within what we are calling our planetary boundaries. They can't handle the pressure we are putting on. And we all have a responsibility and we have an opportunity to do something. So I hope that this message is percolating and going and reaching everybody. My initial target was to reach 5 billion people. I hope we are getting there.
The numbers we're speaking of here, 5 billion people, it's the truth of the matter. We're talking about also these growth numbers by 2050 reaching 9+ billion people. So these are real problems. And what I find fascinating or concerning, I guess, is often our existing food systems as is have been failing the most vulnerable. Too many are going without while others produce and consume to excess. And they are stressing those planetary boundaries, yet we're still not fulfilling the needs of so many. So how will the Food System Summit begin to offer these solutions to these big challenges?
So that's a very important point. It's the fact that too many people are going without food does not mean that we are not producing enough. We are probably producing 5 times more food than we need in the world. We have a lot of waste in our midst. We are wasting over $1 trillion worth of food. So the challenge is not how we are producing food or whether we are producing food. The challenge is the inequities that exist in our food system. And those are some of the things that we need to address. So through the solution clusters that we have put, the action tracks that are in place now, studying possible solutions and game-changing ideas that are being put in place, we have been able to mobilize and identify over 2,500 game-changing ideas through 5 action tracks of the summit. And these have been all consolidated into about 52 solutions, which 52 solutions can help identify, can help really solve specific challenges in the food system. Some of them can be deployed together, some of them can be deployed individually, but the idea was to make sure that whatever problem a country is struggling with, whatever problem a community is struggling with, there's a solution to match. And these ideas are now available and these solutions available with a whole lot of institutions and people that they can reach and be able to get the support that they need. So this is a future of the Food System Summit that we're extremely proud of.
Understandably, yeah. I mean, the network effect, the engagement process you spoke to, Also, I think one thing that has become clear, right, is that in this last decade, we've realized the world needs to rethink the way we produce, consume, and dispose of this food. It's evident that, as you said, three times daily, we can vote for each other and the planet in what we decide to eat and how it's produced. So, Agnes, let me share with our audience just a quick bit about your background and kind of this appointment and why it's so important. So a special envoy, Dr. Kalibata, works with the United Nations system for key partnerships to provide leadership guidance and strategic direction towards the 2021 Food System Summit. She is responsible for outreach and cooperation with key leaders, including governments, to ensure the summit serves as a catalytic process within the decade of action, to improve the food systems around the world to deliver on the Sustainable Development Goals and the Paris Agreement. So how do you engage with other parts of the UN and other governments around forthcoming summits around the ocean, biodiversity, climate, things you had mentioned, but seems in past have run in silos? How can you have this network effect and engage other divisions where food is the common denominator?
What we've done, we've started at country level. What we've done at country level is we've ensured that the conversation around food is broken into five critical areas, which are really the principal areas of our action tracks. We definitely worry about nourishing people, so that's access to safe and nutritious food. We worry about consumption and how sustainable that is. We look at our contribution to climate change and biodiversity loss. We look at equity, I just talked to you about it, and better livelihoods. And then we look at resilience. So if you look at those four areas, we try to ensure that at country level, the conversation across sectoral conversations happening. So that's number one. Now, on a global scale, the number of conversations that are already happening around climate change, there's a COP on climate change that is coming up, COP26. There's COP15 on biodiversity that is coming up. So it's not like these areas are not being discussed, but we are recognizing that the food system has a huge footprint on these areas. So what we do through a separate initiative of the Secretary General, we do have frequent monthly meetings to have conversations around how we can enrich each other in terms of how each conversation feeds into the other, how we also ensure that the messaging around these conversations are adding up to ensure that the people that are working on climate change and COP26 do understand the impact of food systems on climate change, that actually it would be possible to completely achieve 1.5 without focusing on how the contribution from food systems is going to work as well, or even achieve the COP15 targets without engaging food systems. So we do have dialogues. We've had several dialogues with different summits that are already planned, the Oceans Summit. The plan being to ensure that we are really expounding each other's messages, and we are making sure that we are aligned, and we're encouraging the community as well that is listening to us, that these messages are not going past each other, but we are adding up. We do recognize that there's nobody that is particularly responsible, that each of us are recognizing our individual responsibility, ensuring that we come through. So I would say that we've been extremely successful in linking up with all these parts of the conversation that are already happening, clearly bringing forth the contribution and role of food systems, taking responsibility for that, but also helping the community understand that we have a responsibility to come through on these other pieces that are not necessarily food or ending hunger or feeding people.
I understand you've received a bit of pressure tied to this, some by civil society, that the summit is not a complete open process, that it's not specifically the People's Summit, that there's an underpinning, or the belief was that there's an underpinning that it's secretly driven by big ag and big food. Do you care to share some thoughts on that?
I think this whole idea of corporate interest in food systems, I mean, it's not that it's not unfounded. It's true that corporates own a huge part or have a huge role in food systems. So recognizing that is definitely one of the things we have to do. The question that we struggle with in the Food Systems Summit is whether because they are part of a huge part of the food system, whether we should lock them out of conversations. What I've been saying is that we really need to lean in and take and have courageous conversations rather than try to lock any of us out. We need each other. I told you how we need each of us. I can't be speaking to each of us individually and lock out a certain part of society, even though we may not agree with them. My message usually is and still is, let's be courageous. Let's call out what we think should change. Let's be very clear on what we think should not be happening in our food system today. And let's hold people to account, but let's not lock anybody out of these conversations because it can only make it worse. Everybody has something to contribute. Each of us has something to contribute. We need each of us to feel the responsibility we hold. We cannot do that by locking people out of conversations.
I find it fascinating in those situations because, you know, this is not a vacuum. We live in the real world. It's the cat's out of the bag, and that's a major player in the global food system or big agricultural companies. If we really want to accomplish these goals, we all have to have a seat at the table, as you're speaking to, Agnes. I mean, we have to incorporate this. And ultimately, these large corporations and organizations are a response to us, the consumers. And if we change the dynamic, if we decide we are empowered to make these better decisions and drive food systems that are more responsible, more regenerative, more sustainable, then ultimately the response from them is more in conjunction with what the goals are. It would seem, at least maybe I'm living in an ideological world.
I think that is very true. I just wanted to also add that we need to recognize that all this work happens in a country somewhere. Yeah. There are countries that are setting policies. There are countries that are ensuring that the right thing is done. So I also want to make sure that I appreciate the role of civil society to bring out issues. So really standing out and being clear on issues that need to be resolved is important. And I would encourage, as we support member states, for them to also work on resolving some of these issues as they are brought out, so that we can have a society where we are all able to speak to each other rather than avoid each other. So we all have a responsibility. Member states need to resolve the issues. Civil society is good at bringing them out, and we should respect that. And private sector should listen and build the confidence and trust that the rest of the landscape needs them to build. So I think that's what we are working towards in these meetings, in this type of summit, by bringing everybody around the table. That was really the initial intention. Let's have conversations that can allow us to find solutions together.
I love it. A bit more about your background. I want to set a bit of a stage here because I think our listening audience should hear more of this and should appreciate the perspective. Born in Rwanda, smallholder farmers displaced during the struggle for independence in the early 1960s, Dr. Kalibata grew up at a refugee camp in Uganda, where her parents grew beans, maize, and kept cows. The education of Dr. Kalibata and her siblings was funded through the family's income from agriculture. Do you make a correlation to growing up and growing your own crops on land granted to you and your family in a refugee camp as something that helped empower you to excel to such heights?
No, I think the biggest correlation I make to growing up in a refugee camp and what I'm doing today comes, one, yes, from growing up in a refugee camp and seeing that farming is an possibility, is an opportunity that people use to get out, to improve livelihoods. But I also got so much more when I went into the agricultural sector and understood that farming does not have to be about subsistence, about feeding your children and being able to just buy a few things here and there, that farming actually can be a major business. So for me, it's reconciling those types of livelihoods, the life that I saw my parents growing in that was pretty subsistence, and the life that I see people have in functional agricultural systems, and trying to really understanding and being really telling myself that I can make a difference to people that are struggling, because they are still there, that are struggling like my parents were struggling. If they have access and choice choice and are able to make the right choices in the agricultural sector that can help improve and change their lives, like I see people do in other in other places every day. And this is when people have access to good inputs and use good seeds and have access to markets. These people thrive. And I just get surprised at how very little my parents had, even though they had access to land, and how very little they were able to thrive the way they should have. So I feel like my responsibility to reconcile those types of lives, the life that I saw my parents growing up in, and the life that I see people living today in functional agricultural systems that I would have loved to see my parents grow with.
I one quick anecdote here. I was reading your background, doing some research for this conversation. I read about how, as a young adult, you were accepted and received a scholarship to the most prestigious girls' school in Uganda. For this, you walked 12 kilometers to the train, and then you took a two-day train ride to get there. I heard you share this epiphany that you had, that during these trips, it wasn't a burden on your shoulders. This is a young teenage kid, but an opportunity, just as you spoke to there. And the anecdote I wanted to share was, as I took a break to do my research, I went down to the local Starbucks. I actually live near where you got your PhD at UMass, University of Massachusetts. And I saw this gentleman berating this poor Starbucks worker about the coffee being too cold. And I thought, wow, gosh, we just got to gain some perspective, some point of view. It's more of just taking a step back and being appreciative and empathetic towards other people's struggles and appreciating that and understanding where people are coming from. But more so, I look at it from where you're coming from is that everything I hear from you is always this positive point of view, that everything is not a burden, but an opportunity. It's all how you look at that. Could you tell our listening audience some of how these experiences have shaped you in gaining such positive perspective?
So that's very interesting. Listen, growing up, I came to appreciate two things. I came to appreciate that I really needed to, there was a huge expectation on me that I needed to work hard, that I could definitely, there was a whole lot of life out there that I didn't understand. Of course, I grew up in a very rural setting where you're shielded from what is happening in the world. You don't see a TV, you don't see a telephone. I mean, all those are things that I came to learn later, but my dad did have a sense of what was out there. So his expectations were extremely high. So working hard and coming through an expectation is something that comes naturally to me. So I knew I had to impress him. I knew I had to get things done. So that's something after a while it rubs on you and becomes an expectation. But more importantly, I guess the reason I don't see any of that as a burden is being able to make it through or being able to make it out of that rural livelihood, that refugee livelihood, and realizing as you move on in life that there are only very few of you that were able to make it out of there, and that there are so many other kids that were not able to make it out of there. And then realizing that there's a whole life out there that your people don't know about, are not part of, and yet that's what they should be. And then the sense of responsibility that brings to you. So everything then becomes a gift, everything that allows you to get closer to all these things that life has to offer becomes a gift, and it cannot be a burden. It's a gift because I look at it as an opportunity to be able to give back to a society that really was denied a whole lot. But it's also a gift because I'm able to walk out of that and be part of a completely different society. It just puts so much responsibility on my shoulders, knowing that those kids that didn't make it were perfectly as capable of making it out of there as I, except they just didn't have the same opportunities I had, one of which was getting a UNHCR scholarship and being able to make it out of there. So for me, I always look at it from that perspective. How can I help rural communities out there that actually have something in their hands? They have land, they have their labor, they can farm. And agriculture is an area that can take them out of poverty because I know it can. How do I not disconnect myself from that and instead really use what I have learned and be able to help them get out of it? So today, I'm in this Food Systems Summit mostly because I see these communities struggle with climate change. I feel I have a responsibility for all of us to understand that the communities that live in farming, that we're beginning to make a livelihood out of farming, are actually suffering because of climate change and may never get out of poverty because of climate change, because they are living from one good season to a bad season, to a good season, to a bad season, and it is eroding everything they have. So for me, making decisions to do things like this when they come up is not difficult, because it's an opportunity to be able to stand out for the, and bring my voice out for those communities that I know that are struggling.
Speaking of that leadership voice or that presence, that it's one of those things where if you see someone that is like you or it comes from a similar background, it's much easier to have those aspirational goals, to know you can do that. And I think one of those scenarios that has come to full light in the last few years is, and the fact that on a shrinking planet in dire need of the best and brightest, we don't have half the population. We don't have that many women in these leadership roles, in scientific roles. So from your point of view, coming out from your background and now in this on this stage to kind of share this wisdom, how do we continue to get more young women and girls interested in careers in leadership like you are and in science?
So there are a number of things that can be done. One thing I keep talking about is the place and role that my own father had in my upbringing. Just being able to have a parent that draws you out and as a girl child and give you the opportunity. It's not something I take for granted, because again, I know many young girls who didn't have the same opportunity. So even something as basic as that, which many in modern society take for granted, having your parents pull you in the direction where you'll be able to get a good education, you'll be able to be a scientist, is not something we should take for granted. So that's one. It's important because it's the beginning. The next bit is also then how we continue working on all these issues that hold young girls from school, that make it difficult for them to be part of going to school. Ensuring that early marriages for these rural girls are stopped. So there are so many things that work against young girls, and that's why I was saying that I saw so many of my friends staying behind. So you getting them over that hurdle, ensuring that they get a good education, and once they get through that education, just making sure that there are opportunities, that there are opportunities that young girls can aspire towards, but also ensuring that there are resources that I've thought about it several times, whether I should just get out of my job and go and create a resource for young girls to find a place to talk to them about how making it in life is not extremely difficult if you're focused, if you can have someone pay your school fees to bridge a difficult year, if you can have someone come through for you in difficult places. So we have to be deliberate around facilitating young girls, facilitating young women to be able to have the education they need, but also to be able to make it through school. I got a lot of help, all the way from UNHCR to Rockefeller Foundation Scholarship when I went to my MSc and PhD. These are things I would never have been able to do on my own. Probably my dad was going to take me as far as end of elementary school. After that, it would have been difficult. But I got that help, and I'm just saying that a lot of young women need that help. There are quite a number of odds against them. And I appreciate that there are a number of efforts that really are in place to support young women to make it through school. And we need to double down on those efforts. We should not let those efforts go. We should just double down and ensure that we reach as many girls as possible.
It seems that food systems are one of these, as we have this rekindling approach to reappropriation of how we're going to grow food and produce food and deal with waste in the future. It seems like this entire new forum for discovery, for innovation, for capacity building, and maybe it is that open playing field that allow allows or creates that environment where more women can excel, especially when there's more women in these leadership roles, to be appreciative to your point of having this redundancies, to creating these education systems as opportunities. And I'll say, as a dad of a teenage girl, that maybe I could be considered a little overbearing sometimes, but all with good love. You're making me feel good here, Agnes, that I might be doing the right thing here of keeping on my daughter.
I ask myself the same question. I have a young daughter. I ask myself the same question, whether I'm living up to, I'm doing what my dad would have done. I sometimes ask myself, with the means I have, what would he have done differently?
Yeah.
So I guess that's a struggle that many parents have to live with. But the most important thing is, I try to tell myself that the most important thing is to really do your best to equip your children to be able to be independent, to be able to appreciate that there are things they can do on their own. So I guess there's nothing that would beat that. Give them the means to explore, give them the ability to be independent, and they will surprise you. I get surprised at how much very young kids can do when we give them the right level of independence. Of course, we live in a world that challenges what independence means today, and that puts a lot of pressure on how much you can allow a kid to do and how much you can't allow them to do. But that's a balance we have to find in our lives. I honestly believe that we have to find that balance. As long as we can equip them to be able to do things on their own, they should be okay.
Well, I think every parent that's listening will agree with you. That is the ongoing challenge, is finding a way to, you know, speak to your kids, whatever they're at, to level with them, to appreciate and be empathetic, and then to empower them to, as you said, to be independent. I think that's great advice and great insight. A bit more of your bio. Dr. Kalibata served as the Minister of Agriculture and Animal Resources in Rwanda from 2008 to 2014. The success of Dr. Kalibata's tenure as agriculture minister contributed towards moving her country from food insecure to a food secure status, becoming a reference point for other countries that sought to deliver agricultural transformation. In this time, Dr. Kalibata drove programs that supported smallholders like her father and helped the country recover from continued impact of the 1994 genocide. All right, Agnes, so I was doing a bit more digging here, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I saw that about a dozen years right after the genocide in 2006, Rwanda's 12 provinces were replaced by a number of smaller districts and municipalities with the aim to create a decentralized administration. So 30 plus districts, hundreds of municipalities. So then 2 years after that, you take over as Minister of Agriculture. And just to set the stage for our listening audience, I read that it's estimated that 90% of the working population in Rwanda farms. So you were responsible for 9 out of 10 jobs in the country, and all of that during a complete infrastructure change. How did you deal with this logistical headache?
That's a very interesting question. So you could call it a headache, but it actually could also be a huge opportunity. The opportunity being that with decentralization came the ability for communities to be a little bit more self-determining, a little bit more ability to look at local solutions and be self-determining than waiting for a whole national effort. So I actually think it was a huge opportunity to be able to work in Rwanda at the time when Rwanda was decentralizing and making decentralized entities in kind of independent from central government and having their own governance systems. I worked with each of the 30 district mayors and 461 sector leaders, and probably knew each of them by name. And the idea here again is about how you really look at each community from where it's at. Rwanda is a small country, but also a very rich country in terms of agroecologies, and just being able to focus on every agroecology for what it offers was something that we needed to look at. And the need to look at that comes mostly from a number of places, maybe two places. The fact that most land holdings in Rwanda are pretty small, and because of that, to be able to drive a viable agricultural system on very, very small land holdings was challenging. The second opportunity there was the fact that land is actually owned. Land tenure is liberalized, so everybody owns their land. So we combined the two. We combined the fact that lands are small, and then land ownership happens. We have 10 point something million parcels of land, and we build something we called land consolidation. So with farmers that are not worried about losing their land, the identity of their land, because their identity is on paper rather than physical presence on the ground. With farmers that have small plots of land, it was not very difficult to convince them to bulk their land, to do something more viable where both all of them could benefit together. So our agricultural system was really based around helping farmers bulk their activities. So if you're going to grow beans, let's grow beans that are iron fortified, that are high yielding, that have better market value, so that when we put them on the market, we actually have enough surplus to put on the market, and we actually have a market that is interested in what we are doing. And we actually have, because we've consolidated, we actually can afford to have an extensionist talking to about 500 to farmers that are on 500 hectares together, which are probably about 300 farmers, right? So the cost of reaching them becomes easier. The ability to engage them and to around advancing a value chain that they can all benefit from becomes easier. And all that was possible, one, because we had decentralized governments that I could, where I could engage with local administration very easily, but also because we had a land tenure system that allowed me to engage the citizens very easily. So the government put in a lot of effort. It was not an Agnes Kalibata effort. It was a whole of government Rwanda effort. And my job was to really shepherd this process and ensure that we bring it to fruition, working with other leaders that were responsible for local government. And mine was really just to ensure that farmers understand the benefit that we could bring to them if we worked together. So that's how we did it, really. And we then found them, we ensured that they had access to better yielding seeds, inputs, and also they had access to markets because they were working together in whether they could produce surplus. So every challenge, I'm sure, has a solution. In this case, the Rwanda's biggest challenge, which is very small land holdings, and the opportunity, which was land, good land tenure, we combined and made it a huge opportunity for food production.
I'm an entrepreneur, so I kind of have that same perspective that all challenges are opportunities, but to the point where we were speaking earlier, I think it's your unique point of view of the glass half full and your capacity to shepherd that through, but just impressive work. Now, looking back since you've been past that job, now 7 years, where do things stand in Rwanda? Did your institution of these practices, did the new approach, did the systems-based approach of investing in the seed all the way through fruition and the market, has it borne fruit? Are they still seeing positive uptick in where things are at with the agricultural systems in Rwanda?
It's actually amazing. One of the things that I really think was great there is my own learning that actually a system could be moved to a tipping point. And I think that the Rwandan food security system of agricultural system, we were able in those 8 years to move them to a tipping point, because today the system is working. The government continues to invest in that system. The opportunities are huge. Farmers continue to invest in getting better out of their small pieces of land. They continue to invest in accessing markets better. So I would say that actually they are doing much better today than they were probably doing when I was there. So I believe there was an effect of what was started then. But again, the opportunity there being the decentralized entities that are supporting this are still in place. So I think the all these things in the end come to work together. I think Rwanda's biggest biggest opportunity is that the fact that the government is committed to what it does, and the decentralized entities have been given the authority and the empowerment to drive some of these local development initiatives. And again, farmers are able to embrace things that make a difference in their lives. And with that, you have a perfect combination of what you're calling a tipping point, and the rest is how you maintain that momentum. I think that Rwanda has enough momentum based on those factors to continue pushing forward.
Well, next time I see my man in Starbucks yelling at his barista for all the problems he has and being too cold, I now have something to share with him and say, just listen to this conversation. Be empathetic of everybody involved in this supply chain to know what's really gone. So thank you for that. That's good. I'm going to share that with him next time I see him.
And remember to let him know that some of that coffee comes from Rwanda.
Exactly. Right? I mean, some of the best in the world, right? I'm going to just share with them. And say, look where it comes from, my friend. Take a step back. Gain some perspective. So good stuff. Let's go back to present day here and maybe in future scope. What does a successful food system summit look like when it's all said and done here?
So what we are hoping for is that we can actually come to a place where we all agree that we should have a major transition in our food system. We should stop producing food in ways that we are creating so much waste. We should stop producing food in ways that we are contributing to emissions. And we should stop producing food in ways that is completely degrading our biodiversity. So success, to be able to achieve that, I'm hoping that we can have every country that is coming to the Food Systems Summit, every country that is part of this globe, designing a food system pathway that recognizes that producing food needs a food system perspective. And these pathways are strategies where different sectors in a country get to work together to agree that they, going forward, they actually need to be working from a food system perspective rather than just food perspective. So that's number one, having food system pathways that recognize that we need to produce food in a way that is reducing our impact on the environment. Number two is ensuring that we're actually producing food where we need it. There are lots of people that need food. There are lots of people that can't afford enough food. We need to start putting in place mechanisms that allow equity of food in places where people don't have enough, in places where producing food is still constrained. And there are solutions based on what we've been doing in our food systems action tracks. There are solutions. We hope that these solutions can be used to build coalitions that can support those countries that need help in building resilience, that need help in strengthening productive systems, that need help in reducing impact on climate change. So there are solutions now that are available, and we need to use those to build coalitions to help communities come through. I hope that those two areas, ability to use solutions to build coalitions that can help us come through, number one. Number two, using national pathways as strategies to come through on food systems as a whole of a country's effort. And then lastly, a real call from the Secretary General himself, a real direction from the Secretary General himself in his call to action, providing new direction for food systems, recognizing food world that coming through on SDGs will require a completely new direction for food systems.
Well, Dr. Kalabata, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share such wisdom. I learned a great deal. I know our listening audience will as well.